Hey, Pet Pros! This episode's sponsor is Hikari. With a heritage spanning nearly 140 years, Hikari is the pioneer in creating specialized diet and aquatic solutions dedicated to the health and vibrancy of your underwater companions.
Carly, did you know I've trusted and sold Hikari products for 23 years? Hikari's legacy is built on delivering premium nutrition through species-specific diets, including a wide range of frozen foods designed to mimic natural feeding patterns. Crafted in Japan, they have complete control over their processes, which is rare. Their products are trusted by hobbyists around the globe, thanks to their relentless pursuit of quality and commitment to research and development.
But nutrition is just the beginning. Hikari's comprehensive aquatic care line includes essential aquarium medications, sponge filter kits, and high-performance pumps. Every product is designed with the well-being of your aquatic pets in mind, ensuring a healthy and thriving environment.
Hikari is more than a brand. It's a symbol of trust and excellence in aquatic care. Join the global community of enthusiasts and retailers who choose Hikari for comprehensive aquatic nutrition and care. Embrace the Hikari way, where love for aquatic life meets the pinnacle of scientific innovation.
Learn more at HikariUSA.com.
Attention, independent pet pros. Let me introduce you to the Pet Shop Girls, presented by Pet Product News.
Hey, everybody. I'm Sherry.
And I'm Carly.
And welcome to the Pet Shop Girls podcast. In this episode, we have a bit of a history lesson for you. I personally wanted to share this story because so many people I've met in the industry have no idea where we've come from, and in turn, where we may be going. We're talking about a man who revolutionized the pet industry as we know it today. May the spotlight shine on this elusive figure whose groundbreaking research and visionary thoughts have profoundly shaped our industry. That's right, we are talking about Dr. Herbert Axelrod, a name synonymous with pioneering contributions to the aquatic life studies, as well as reptiles, small animals, and birds. Despite the scarcity of written records, Dr. Axelrod's legacy as a trailblazer who redefined the pet trade is undeniable. To help us piece together the story of this influential man is my personal pet expert, Mike Doan. Mike knows more about Dr. Axelrod than anyone I've met. He's also been in the pet industry for 45 years. From wholesale to retail, from fish to birds to dogs, he's done it all. He also happens to be my husband and business partner. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hello.
Yay.
Yay, applause.
All right. Tell us briefly a little bit about your pet industry experience.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've worked in the industry, like you said, since I was a kid. I started collecting reptiles because I lived in Texas and reptiles were abundant, and I would collect them and sell them to the local pet store. I got into fish much later. I started off really into birds and dogs, and later I expanded into a strong interest in tropical fish and birds really forever. I've owned a lot of exotic birds, everything from blue and golden macaws to African grays. And of course, I still have a parakeet in the house.
You also built aquariums and were in the wholesale fish trade.
That's right. Yeah. So I've worked the manufacturing side of the industry, building aquariums and enclosures, and also, as she said, worked in wholesale facilities where we imported marine fish from all over the world into a central holding facility. And then we distributed those to pet stores in the Dallas area. And so that's mine. And I've worked in, I don't know, I can't count how many pet stores. I've also been a dog groomer, also been a dog bather, a kennel attendant, and I still get to do some of those things even now as I own a kennel and bathing area and a grooming salon. So, yeah,
and that's kind of my story. Obviously an entrepreneur since birth, since you were collecting lizards.
Lizards and small snakes. Yeah, I would have been turtles. We were able to sell all of that stuff directly to the pet stores. They would either give us store credit or they would give us cash on the barrelhead. When I was a pretty good snake finder, so I was making money as a kid.
You're one of the most seasoned pet industry people I've ever met. You brought to light this story of Dr. Axelrod to me, and I thought it was absolutely amazing. Why should we care about this guy, and what did he do?
Okay, yeah, Axelrod. He, around sometime in the early 50s, he became the world-leading authority on tropical fish, okay? I'm going to read this little bio from a Sports Illustrated article, which is one of the only articles in existence about this guy's life. And in this one short paragraph, it pretty much lays out who this guy is. And then we can talk about some of the things that he did post fish as a hobby, which, again, I don't think very many people realize that tropical fish has been a thing in America since the 20s. 1920s was when they started actually keeping fish in aquariums. It was mostly goldfish, and goldfish were all the rage. And this guy changed that. And here's a quick bio on Axelrod. So he was a classically trained ichthyologist. So he was, in fact, a scientist. In fact, he was harassed a lot for making money off of science instead of just being a pure scientist. He actually wanted to make money off of his science, but he was an ichthyologist and a legit explorer. He made more than 40 expeditions to South America, Africa, Australia, the Fijis, Indonesia, Thailand, India, and the Malay Archipelago. He claimed, recognize over 7,000 species of fish on site and has discovered hundreds of species that were lost to science for years. And better yet, many fish that we've never seen before. More than 24 species of fish have been named after him. I have some in my store right now, the most important one being the Charadon axelrodi, or Charadon axelrodi, depending on how you like to pronounce the Latin names, the cardinal tetra, and it's the number one selling fish on the planet in tropical fish husbandry. It is the number one fish. Besides all of that, remarkable discoverer. He has written more than half a dozen major books on fish. All were bestsellers. His first book was one that, as a fish keeper, I've had ever since I was a kid. His first book was Tropical Fish as a Hobby. It's been in its ninth printing. It's sold more than 80,000 copies. He's churned out more than 100 smaller books and pamphlets on fish and several hundred articles as well. This all goes to the main thing in this conversation is that he created Tropical Fish Hobbyist Magazine, which gave birth to TFH Publishing. And from the 70s all the way through the late 90s and into the early 2000s, just before the internet, TFH Publishing was the leading publisher of all animal books, whether it was about dogs, cats, fish, birds, reptiles. He had the individual book on every single creature, and most of them he either wrote or edited to make sure that they were correct. He spoke like 5 different languages and did countless expeditions into the Amazon himself, where he would constantly discover new fish, export them back to the United States. He also took over large sections of property near Tampa, Florida, which I believe is where Plant City, Florida is. I'm not 100% certain on that, but he created a large fish farm area so that he could actually breed all of these fish that he was importing from all over the world. Many that he discovered, many that other people discovered, literally creating and owning basically the single source for all tropical fish. And he also opened up pet stores in mini malls and all over the country. So he had a real big idea about how to engage children into keeping animals as pets for both science and for learning and understanding how to keep dogs and cats and keep them all as pets and basically doing it for the betterment of kids. So he really did engage the youth through the common, what we know of today as a pet store, was pretty much his invention. Prior to that, pets were often sold in 5-and-dime stores. Dogs were sold anywhere and everywhere. You bought your pet food at the feed store. You didn't go to a pet shop to buy food. He also secured food. He actually flew to Canada sometime in the 60s, I believe it was. He leased three of the great salt lakes that are in Canada specifically so he could harvest the brine shrimp, which he then turned around and leased the lakes to one of the grand old fish food companies, Wardley. So this guy's like an entrepreneur on levels that it's really hard to describe. Again, I mean, one of his better stories and one that always intrigues me, and it's a little controversial today, but Walt Disney actually...
This story is very controversial. Let me just say, step in here, but I find it also very interesting.
Walt Disney hired him to go into the Amazon to find a Black Panther, two Black Panthers, for an upcoming film on nature. So back in the early 70s, Disney loved doing these wildlife nature films. He charged Dr. Herbert Axelrod to go into the Amazon and get these Black Panthers and bring them back. He took a friend with him, and they found one Black Panther, and they could not find a second one. So what they literally did was they trapped a normal jaguar, they anesthetized it, took it to a local hairdresser somewhere in probably Medellin, Colombia, had his fur dyed black, and then they shipped him off to Disney to satisfy the contract. So,
and that's the 50s for you.
That's the 60s, right? Yeah. It was crazy. So he was out there on a level. In fact, most people don't know that the Russian gerbil that we have today in pet stores, and they're fading now as a pet. He brought the gerbil in to replace the hamster. He believed that the hamster was a horrible pet for children because they were nocturnal and they would bite you. And the gerbils turned out to not only be cuter, had softer fur, they were diurnal, so they were hanging out during the day, and they were far less likely to bite kids, which gave birth to Habitrail, which was the ultimate gerbil playground. That was all because of Axelrod. So none of those things would have even been considered to be a pet for a child to have. So that's why I think we need to all sit back a little bit and pay a little tribute to this guy. Apparently, though, he has a lot of controversial things about him. He got a lot of tax trouble with the IRS.
Besides the jaguar thing, yeah. He was controversial in other respects. And what was that?
Yeah, he got in some tax trouble with the U.S. and he had some auspicious Stradivarius violins in his possession. Apparently, he parked his yacht off the coast of Cuba for several years until he could make himself right with the U.S. But he did make it back into the country. Apparently, he died not too long ago.
I think, 10-ish years ago.
Somewhere in New Jersey. He had a building there where he loved his racing pigeons. In the end, he was all about pigeons. That was his ultimate love of all things, was racing pigeons and flying pigeons. So he's a man right after my own heart. If there's anything that I want more than anything right now, it's probably pigeons as well. But yeah, so I can answer any questions about the guy. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I could tell you before we go on to what.
So hold on. I just want to jump in here and be like, okay, please. So he went to South America and actually trudged through the rainforest and went into these rivers and found these new species. Is that what you're telling me?
Literally. So he dug out canoes, speaking Aboriginal languages throughout the Amazon. He spoke three or four dialects of Amazonian dialects that weren't, they're totally native to the region. He had guides that trusted him and took him deep into hostile territory, like the orchid hunters of the late 1800s. He was truly going to places where he could have died just from any disease, and as well as just arrows to the head. He was definitely in the thing, all to discover fish.
So he's like Indiana Jones, or you could say Ixiana Jones.
That's my favorite. Ixiana Jones. He is. He's the Indiana Jones of the all pet industry. And it's a crazy story.
And Axelrod, for my other pet pros, not to be confused with Axl Rose, because that's... There's no Guns N' Roses here. But so he did, as you said, Mike, he laid the foundation and kind of brought pet or the industry under one roof, rather than going to the Five and Dime to buy your dog and then going to a feed store. So he had that vision that we're all trying to live today, which is to have that all-in-one, under-one-roof specialty pet shop.
Yeah, I would qualify him as probably the founder of the concept of the modern pet store. I think there were a few back in the day. We all are familiar with the 1950s, with a puppy in the window, but those were mostly feed stores. And yeah, they did sell finches and canaries. Those were very popular in the early 1900s. Budgies, I don't know exactly when the English parakeet showed up in the U.S., but they was all small birds until Axelrod came along. Then we started getting parrots. Then we started getting exotic fish and the gerbil and of course, the dogs actually being sold in the pet store. That's mm-hmm. when all of that began. In fact, we probably inadvertently gave birth to puppy mills. Prior to that, all of the dogs that were being bred by ethical breeders who were just into their line of dogs, and they would definitely protect the line of the dogs they were breeding. And until the dogs started getting sold in pet shops and they needed that commodity, there probably really wasn't much of an interest from the Amish people in Indiana to breed dogs until there was actually a market for it. Right. And I think that was probably, you know, one of the side effects of that.
Right. So, and now you've just undid all his good by saying that he started puppy mills.
That's right.
So if we take a look at kind of the groundwork or the history that he laid to get us to where we are now, I'm going to throw it out to the two of you because you have your store, you have dog and cat supply, you have some small animal supply too, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Supply.
Yeah.
Supply.
Yeah. We don't carry the small animals. The only animals we carry are our fish, tropical fish.
Yes. But you do have some small animal supply.
Yeah.
And then you have the fish and you do the education on the fish. So you guys, obviously, you have more of that model than I do with just cat and dog. But my question is, now that kind of history, that foundation has been laid, we are where we are today. What do you guys see for the pet industry today?
Today, I feel like we're in a mini recession, at least here in the U.S., and I think it may be affecting Canada too.
Yeah.
So, and it's not like that's the first time we've been in a recession. And when we first started Odyssey Pets, it was in 2006, and then
2008, we went immediately into a legit recession.
And the pet industry is resilient. It has proven that. You got to hold on to your pants and get through the hard times, because the good times are just on the other side.
Yeah. I think so a couple things echoing what you're saying. And I've always said that the pet industry isn't recession proof, but it is recession resistant, because pets gots to eat. So if we're the grocery store for pets, it's just like a recession for people. You still have to get groceries, right? So pets still have to eat. Now, pet parents today, because of the current economic climate, may not be buying all of the extras, 3 toys each time they come and lots of treats and chews and accessories. They're looking to buy food. But at least as pet store owners, we can all be thankful that many pet parents are still choosing to feed the quality foods that we sell and not going, I'm going to run off and I'll just get my food at Costco because it's cheaper. Some are doing that and it's out of necessity, right? The animal still needs to eat. I think too, when you talk about the highs and lows, this is the number of pet ownership or the number of pets in homes today is higher than it ever was before. And of course, we have COVID to thank for that. We also have COVID to thank for this mini recession. But when COVID happened and that many more pet parents brought furry guys into their homes as pet store owners, is a fantastic thing for us because we have to serve more clients with pets. But yeah, what you said too, Sherry, like we've got to weather the storm. We've got to get creative and to try to get through this little mini recession. What are some of the things that you guys are doing or some of the change that you've temporarily implemented in order to weather this storm?
The first thing that pops into my mind that's not going to be temporary, I am expanding my freezer section. And I know that raw and gently cooked foods are more expensive. And my sales have taken a little bit of a dip, but the growth of that sector of pet food has been so great that I think once this mini recession is passed, it's going to bounce back with a vengeance. And so I'm going to poise myself and be ready to capitalize on that by adding more freezers.
Yep.
Yeah, it gets people into your store more often. It is the best, most species appropriate foods available. So we are helping the pets. Mm-hmm. And most people don't have enough space to bulk up on it. So that, yeah, they have to come in a lot.
Yeah. And they do, like you said, raw is the fastest growing segment of the pet food industry right now. And even though we are seeing a little bit of a cutback or people trying to find ways to still feed their pets the best they can afford right now, I agree with you that when we weather this storm and we get through the other side, we are going to see a bigger uptick. And I say that because I look at when I wrote my business plan in 2017, the numbers of fresh feeding pet parents was 10%. And in 2021, that number was 20%. And now the latest numbers I've seen for 2024 is up to 35% of pet parents are including some sort of fresh food in the pet's bowl. They may not be completely raw fed pets, but they're getting some. So we're making strides in the right direction.
That's amazing. Those are really good stats. That's very encouraging.
Listen, I don't research the news. I just make it myself. So.
Mike, did you have something to add?
I wanted to answer that question a little more clearly about the exotics aspect of what's happening in the pet industry. Okay, I honestly believe that the pet industry itself hasn't fully accepted or addressed the issue of the cell phone. Okay, I think it has replaced the pet. Specifically, the gerbil, the parakeet, the hamster, and in many ways, it has replaced the interest in having pets completely. That's why I like at Odyssey, we don't sell gerbils. I don't sell reptiles. I don't sell birds. It's not because I wouldn't if we could sell them efficiently and, you know, sell them to be there is no interest. Among kids, it's the interest has gone so low that it's practically impossible for me to devote the floor space to those kinds of animals. Now, PetSmart is still doing it, and so is Pet, but their market share is still sinking on that stuff. And somehow, and I don't know how we break through to the kids, because it's really not about, again, when you look to the future of any industry, even love of dogs and cats, if the focus is completely on that handheld device and you look at kids today, they're face down in their phone. By the time they're 13 years old, they'll never look up again. They're done. And it's really trying to get people out of that and back into even the dog, the cat, much less the aquarium or a parakeet or something that involves responsibility and interaction and engagement, which again, if you look back at Axelrod and you look at back at his dream, it was to engage children to make future customers. He really was. Again, this is a scientist who was trying to make money off of science and biology. He did not foresee the cell phone stealing the interest of children and basically taking away the future of the pet industry and any interest in any engagement with the natural world, which is the last bastion of aquariums. Like when you have an aquarium in your home, it's still a screen. Right? Kids will still walk up to it just like it's a TV set, except it's a living screen and it's different. They pay attention to it in a different way and it affects their biology in a different way. It affects their brains in a different way. The same is true if you have a dog. You know, you have a kid sitting there staring at their phone and you check their heart rate and it's through the roof. And then you take the phone away and you put a dog in their lap, heart rate drops, the kid calms down. All of a sudden, he wants to go outside and play. This is something that we, as a pet industry, need to grapple with. And it's one of those things that, like, people like Axelrod, who really loved, and there's a lot of people like him. He wasn't the only one. He was just one of the really big ones who saw a lot of stuff in the future to make this better, right? And to make this engagement with the natural world for the atomic family, the 2.5 kids and a dog and mom and dad and all this thing, to make it so that they can engage with the natural world. And now we're slowly losing that. That's my biggest concern. Mm-hmm. And my goal is to open that door back up, get kids off the phone, get them into a dog, get them into an aquarium. But one of the reasons why I no longer really want to sell birds is because I don't believe that they are well cared for, right? If you can really care for the tropical bird well and provide it with flight and space and activity and engagement, then I promote it 100%.
Yeah.
Our engagement with the natural world is really important, even if it is just with our dog, our cat. But I think that's my goal.
Then you get into the philosophical debate of how good of care is necessary for the pets. How good of a food should you be feeding to your dog to keep the dog? How much flight do you give your bird? But I think that's a whole other podcast.
Right. And I just wanted to bring up if this is about the evolution of the pet industry, we're at a turning point. And I see it in the kids, especially 10 to 40. They have powerful phones. And even if their parents have put controls on those phones, I guarantee you their phones have shown them how to get around it.
Yes. That's an interesting thought. I guess the Tamagotchi was also the first kick at trying to replace pets, but you're right. I never thought about the impact of the phone. I think back to when my nephew was just a little guy, and the TV was on in the living room, and he walked up to the TV and put his two fingers on the screen and started trying to swipe.
Swipe, yeah.
Stop.
Right? He did. And he was just a little guy, and we all laughed. But that's what he grew up knowing, right? He was always on a device swiping as a little kid. So he walked up to the TV and was trying to swipe it. But that's something that I never thought about, that it's, I guess I should have, because even with dogs and cats, there's tons of research that suggests when you're going to spend quality time with your dog, put the phone down. They know that you're not giving them your undivided attention. And you see it all the time. At dog parks, you'll see pet parents. They've got their dog running around and they're on their phone. So they're not paying attention to what's happening with their animal. They think, oh, he's at the dog park. He'll just run. That's probably why fights happen, because nobody's because we're looking at the phones. So I guess to the future, aside from, I think what we all do today as independent pet pros, we do a lot of education. And I think that the majority of our education is probably, I know in my store, it's really focused on education, natural pet care for our animals. But that, I guess, could also be worked into the education that we provide pet parents of all types of pets, is how do you still bring nature into your life and without always having your phone in your hand, because That's not natural, right?
It's our last hope. Really, we've got to put the phones down. We've got to get everyone to do it. And as pet pros, as people who, I'm just in the same way as Axelrod, I am fascinated with the natural world and I've chosen to make a living at it. I've chosen this to be my life. And so I need to make money at it because that's what people do. That's my business choice. I want to do it ethically. I want to do it right. But it terrifies me to see the future customers slowly slipping away. Like you said, more pets are in the home now than ever before. That's mostly dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Like I said, I want the animals that are going to be kept ethically to be the ones who are kept. Sherry pointed out the reptile industry, like that was also in pet stores at one time. But because the reptile breeders went direct to the public about 20 years ago, they just completely shut down any need for any store to ever sell a reptile again. And they took that business away from the stores by cutting out the middleman. The pet shop was the middleman in that case.
One of the reasons we don't try to sell the reptiles is because the reptile shows popped up and they're selling direct to the public for less than what we could sell to them to. It's not that people don't have reptiles. It's that having them in my store doesn't make monetary sense.
Yeah.
And then the food. We're talking live mice, live rats. That takes maintenance and personnel to care for the live rats and live mice that then need to be fed to the reptiles. And so it's just a lost leader all the way around. And that's why we don't sell it. It's not because we don't love them as pets and want to sell them to make a profit. But again, it's one of those challenges that the pet industry has presented to brick and mortar store owners. It's the threat of Chewy.com on crack when people are selling the products that we're trying to sell directly to the public at a price cheaper than I can buy it for wholesale because I don't buy enough.
Yeah. It makes me think too, when you guys, when we're talking about kind of the future of the industry and everything happens in cycles, right? We saw that reptiles used to be in the store and now they're going direct to consumer. We're seeing that a lot with different food brands.
Yeah.
They're going direct.
Farmer dog, man, direct to customer.
But even a lot of farmer's dog, at least they're fresh, but that was their model, DTC, right? Direct to consumer. We're seeing a lot of the dry brands doing that or going on live line through Chewy. What are you guys doing? I think the freezers are one of the, I don't want to say safeguards, but for lack of a better term, I'm going to say safeguards. Freezers are definitely a way to try to secure some of that future business. What other things are you guys doing or putting in place to try to anticipate the future of the pet industry?
I actually think community engagement is the key. Okay. And I've recently learned, and this is really important for people to understand, and because I just learned this, and you'd think I would have known this forever, but I swear to God, I thought that community meant my zip code. Okay. It's just real basic. Okay. The people who live around my store is my community, yada, yada. That's not it. No. Community is the people in your store. It's the people who you're dealing with directly on a day-to-day basis and how you treat them, which is why we want to do the group dog walk. I think that's one of those things, again, where we're all in, no one's going to be on their phones during the dog walk. We're going to engage each other. We're going to engage our pets. We're going to spend time together with no agenda other than getting all of our dogs to walk together in a straight line somewhere from point A to point B and get the dogs over that hump. And that's one of the things. The other thing is bringing in groups of people. I've noticed I had some high school kids who I did some Zoom for their aquatics class. So they Zoomed into my store and then the kids actually started coming to the store. And the teacher has come to the store. They're actually pretty far away. They've got to drive a good distance to get to my store. But because we engaged with, these are high school kids, and because I reached out and engaged with their teacher and with their class, we got kids in our store who are showing interest in fish. And then, of course, when they came into the store, they saw all the cool dog stuff. They saw all the cool other products that we've got. And it told me that they're disassociated. So we've got to reach out to them, mm-hmm. right? I need to engage with more schools. I need to engage with more young groups of kids. I don't know. Maybe I need to talk to the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts and get them in my store and get them off their phones.
Yeah. I think though that Mike, that's a good tip. That is how we can partner tech with pet and kids is they're used to using technology today. They're using Zoom in the classroom, obviously. It would be nothing for them to sit there in their desks and watch the big Zoom on screen. And there's Mike saying, here's the things about the fish. But that's definitely an option. I think pack walks, like you're talking about, are great. We used to do pack walks in my store. And then there's pack walks. And then there's meditative pack walks. And meditative walks are, you go into nature, you go in and find a forest or a park or somewhere where it's not buildings in concrete.
Yes.
But you do these meditative pack walks. There's no phone. There's no talking.
Right.
You know, it's 30, 50, 60 people out with their dogs. And the energy that you feel from a meditative pack walk is amazing because you are just connecting with nature. But getting kids involved in that as well, I think brings them back to what we're trying to do is to get and keep animals healthy and getting them back.
It's easy for us to also forget the kids. We, you know, I have to remember 60, 65% of our clients, the dog is their kid. And so we tend to overlook, and we don't at our store, I think, and probably most people don't intentionally do this, but I think there's a strong possibility of overlooking the need to bring the kids in and to keep that growth happening.
About though with community, sorry, Sherry, I'm just thinking the chance right now that people are like, I got to go get the dog food I'm just going to stop in after work. Or they're looking at it as an errand. They're not looking at it as a family event. So I think that is also for the security of our future in the pet business, why events become so important in your story.
Right.
I was going to say that we don't do them yet, but I know of a fish store that has built out an entire room just to do kids' birthday parties.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot of retail space for that.
It is. But what they're doing is they're fostering that relationship. Yep. And those kids are going to grow up and then they're going to buy aquariums from that store.
Yeah.
So it is, it's genius, really.
Yeah. And I think any way that I agree that my community definitely is within my store. I also believe, though, that I am building a community, a virtual community through the social media platforms, which again, I think that it is critical for us as pet pros to continually build and foster the relationship, those virtual communities. When I look at my TikTok following, it's going up, but the majority of my followers, it used to be 85% of my followers were American. Now it's 95%. So my followers are going up, and the chance of 98% of my US followers ever shopping with me is slim to none. And if I can still continue to educate and ensure that dogs and cats out there, which is, again, my focus, but if I can make sure that we're positively impacting the lives of them and I'm reaching them through my virtual communities, I can still continue to educate that way too.
So I know we're running out of time here. So I just wanted to jump in with one more thing, looking at the future of retail in general, just not just pet, but I believe there is going to be some type of amalgamation of digital and reality blended together. So I've already seen it in, there's like a makeup store I went into and they have these big screens. They're large and you can look at the screen and pick which color of lipstick you want. And it shows up on your face right there. So it's like trying on the makeup virtually, but you're in the store.
Yeah.
So I feel like that type of technology is going to explode. And I'm trying to figure out how I can harness it in my own store. But that's yet to happen.
So I will tell you, it was over 2 years ago. And I said to my team, I had an idea for how I wanted to. We had an opportunity to partner with another local business that was not a competitor of ours, but still in the pet industry. And we had an opportunity that we were going to set up shop in her facility. And my idea at the time,
like a pop-up shop?
Not a pop-up. We were going to be permanent, but we were going to be the retail aspect of her business. And what I had said to my team then, if picture this, Sicily, 1960. No, I'm kidding. I'm not Sophia from the Golden Girls. But okay. What I said to them is imagine an Apple store, but for pets. So I wasn't going to have a great big showroom full of all of my inventory. I was going to have a tiny, very modern, leading edge showroom that maybe had one bag from each of my brands as literally as display. And the rest was all going to be smart TVs that we would walk up to and we could just page through to say what we're going to talk about. Oh, you want to talk about freeze dried? Oh, you want to talk about kibble? Oh, you want to talk about raw? And everything was going to be in the back. Now, I say that's futuristic, but if you think back to the days of consumer distributing, that's how they did it.
We still do it. There's a place here in Dallas. That's how you buy your tools. I can't think of the name of it right off the top of my head, but you go in and you catalog it and then they go into the back and bring it up front for you. It's very lean. It's a very lean design.
Exactly. Very lean. And that's what I was looking at is for us, the space that we had would have been perfect in this facility because we would have had maybe a 400 square foot showroom, which wouldn't cost a lot to outfit. So again, if we're looking at the future of retail, if we can reduce the leaseholds that you have to put into a brick and mortar store, and the back is all going to be warehouse and shelving. I don't have to worry about paint or decor or anything. And I think that there is a place in retail for that. If I could do that store still today, this was a couple years ago, but I mapped it out. It would have cost me 10 grand to outfit that store versus the 60 that it cost me to outfit my current location. And so I think that there is exactly what you were saying too, Sherry. There is going to be a combination of virtual reality going into shopping. I think that eventually people will shop in my store by sitting on their couch, but they will still be on their couch picking up my things and being able to feel it and touch it through the use of virtual reality. I think that is a possibility for retail.
Right. Yeah, the first person that figures out how to partner with Meta on that is when you
can, I'm already on it.
So they can put the visor on and walk into the store?
Yeah.
You already got that?
No, not yet.
That would be so sick, man. Yeah. That's just crazy. But it is coming. Again, we need to make sure we keep our hands in the potting soil.
Yeah. So be prepared. Don't get taken off guard. It's going to happen, you guys. It's going to happen. Yeah.
Stay frosty. Okay, you guys, that was a crash course in the history of where we've come from, where we are today, and where we could potentially go. I think we could talk about this for a long time because I think there is probably a lot of different ways the future of pet and retail in general could go. But I hope that you guys were able to garner some little nuggets out of there and ways that you could possibly position yourself today or in the future to ensure the success of your pet business. So, Pet Pros, until next time, thank you very much for being with us, Mike. And we will see you on the flip side.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this episode, Pet Pro.
Make sure to follow, like, and subscribe.
Just hit all the buttons.
So you never miss the podcast that makes you sit, stay, and beg for more.
The Pet Shop Girls.
Sorry, my dogs are barking.
Like your feet hurt?
No, no.